Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, December 15th, just 10 days until Christmas. Welcome, 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 friends, on into the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. 10 days until Christmas.
Yes.
Is that meaningful to you in some
particular? No, it's just counting down.
It feels like we're getting close.
The year is flying by.
And it feels like there's things you need to do. You got to get them done.
Get them done. The countdown is on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Speaking of counting down, President Trump's approval ratings have been trending down in recent months. As with almost everything around President Donald Trump, it's hard to tell. Is this just a normal thing that happens in the first year of the second term of a presidency? On some level, yes. But there's also this sort of is it singular to Trump dynamic that's playing out, because in the past, his approval numbers have been kind of resilient. He seemed to be able to capture a certain segment of the voter base and keep them in his camp through thick and thin. And so today we're going to sort of poke at this issue of Trump's approval from several angles and issues and try to determine with some panelists whether something meaningful is happening here around President Donald Trump's popularity. We're asking you today, what do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval numbers? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. How you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, we definitely want to hear from you today. Again, the number 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And so we have our trio of news stories.
Start us off.
Yeah, well, the Pennsylvania legislature is on track to end 2025 with the lowest number of new laws passed in a decade. Interesting story on Spotlight PA's website. It's gauging lawmakers' productivity, and it's not looking good, at least when you talk about the number of laws passed. The legislature, according to them, passed about 65 bills this year, an all-time low in 10 years. Not for lack of trying, though. Scores of bills have been introduced. They just are not moving. By comparison, the legislature passed about 162 bills last year, 77 bills the year before that. And there are two session days left. So technically, another bill could get passed, or maybe two, but that's probably not going to happen.
You mentioned it's 10 days from Christmas, right?
The countdown is on. And of course, part of the problem is we have a divided legislature. You know, the Senate is controlled by the GOP, the House by the Democrats, and we have a Democratic governor. And, you know, the issue that comes to my mind is that Pennsylvania has one of the largest, you know, legislatures, full-time legislatures in the country. They have staffs. It's costing taxpayers lots and lots of money. And we sent them to Harrisburg to solve problems. And a lot of problems are not being solved.
Yeah, I care less personally as a voter about the number of bills passed, because that can be dependent on a lot of things. First of all, some things get smushed into budget bills.
Yeah, a lot of stuff was
into
in this code, last budget.
Right? And
yeah.
So sometimes the number of bills passed is not all that meaningful. But as this story points out, and as we discussed off mic, I think the bigger indictment is that some of the big issues that were on the table when this year began are still on the table.
Like SEPTA funding.
SEPTA funding, whether or not they want to tax skill games or legalize marijuana or create some new stream of revenue, that's still not solved. It felt like a kick the can down the road type of legislative session in a lot of ways. Some things happened, some things got done, but it didn't feel like a big problem-solving session for the folks in Harrisburg.
Especially because the budget took months to
for
get
sure.
done.
That's
and
a huge
and then
part of it.
We're going to enter 2026, and guess what? Another budget will be presented, and we hope that it'll get solved a lot faster than this year's.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned SEPTA funding, right? Still out there.
Yeah.
Still waiting for some sort of long-term fix on SEPTA funding. As a result, many SEPTA bus stops do not have digital displays that tell you when the next bus is coming.
You have no idea,
And this is fascinating. An anonymous Philly artist made their own and posted it at a bus stop in South Philly. According to a great piece in The Inquirer, this artist goes by the name Make It Weird. This is a real sign you can see. They posted a real sign with a solar-powered device built into it that connects to an open-source database that tracks SEPTA buses in real time. So the sign says, for instance, next bus coming in 20 minutes, and it is actually tracking that bus.
Pretty cool.
The artist, Make It Weird, is planning to post more of these signs around the city. You know, last year, SEPTA said they would roll out their own iPad-sized screens at bus stops to transmit this very information. But a spokesperson says cybersecurity challenges have kept the agency from posting their own digital placards. So Make It Weird has stepped into the void and posted their own.
Look, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. That's what Make It Weird said. They stepped up. And I swear, people get really tired of the excuses.
Yeah, of course.
And so they just get out there and just get it done. And I mean, this has been a persistent problem. But there are transit authorities around the world that have figured this thing out,
right.
You know, even with the cybersecurity issues. And so this is just one of those things that people kind of feel like, dang, this is what you're supposed to be doing, but I got to get out there and do it myself.
I'm doing it in my shed. Yeah, I do. This is not to make an excuse for SEPTA because they said they
they've been dealing with
out.
A lot.
No. Not even that. I do wonder, like the countdown clocks in general, there's been a lot of consternation over rolling those out on subways and buses and whatever. In time, isn't that technology going to be less and less useful because more and more people will just have that information on their phones?
And they do have the app. You can there's apps available.
Yeah, like you can tell when the bus is coming if you have the SEPTA app or various other apps that use the same information. So I just wonder if on some level it would be wise for SEPTA and other agencies to not invest limited dollars in a technology that over time will become less useful. Now, not everyone has phones or access to the app, so I understand it's still useful for many people.
Yeah, and but the internet is down, you kind of need that.
But
then I guess that probably would affect the screen.
Yeah, that's probably affect the screens too.
Yeah.
Speaking of anonymity.
Yeah. Anonymous
great story
problem
here.
Solvers. Yeah. An anonymous Santa has been performing Christmas miracles by paying off layaway accounts at a Burlington near Wilmington down in Delaware. I just love this story. The man, he spent about $8,000 paying off 50 accounts with balances ranging from $38 to hundreds of dollars. He then walked out of the store, refused to be recognized for his generosity. And this man has apparently been quietly paying off these layaways for 25 years. And so when he came in this year, he was recognized by the store staff. Somebody from the store reached out to Delaware Online. That's where we found this story. They contacted the Santa. He only agreed to go on the record if he could remain anonymous. And Avi, he says, you know, look, he's very fortunate. He doesn't want for anything, but he realizes that a lot of people are not as fortunate. And so he's been doing this in honor of his late mother, who did this years and years ago when he was young. And she paid off like $600 worth of layaways. And it just felt so good. So he's passing it down even to his son.
Yeah, yeah. So the tradition started with the mom.
Yeah.
Now the son, who we don't know who this guy is, but the son does it. And then the son does it with his son.
Well, yes. It's
all
so
anonymously.
Such a good soul. And y'all know I love a good soul story.
So folks that don't know, Cherry does this whole project called the Good Souls Project where she finds people like this and honors them. And you told me that there are people who you would like to honor through the project, but they refuse to do it
because
they will not give away their identity.
Yeah.
That's an interesting kind of person who really wants to help, but refuses any recognition.
They don't want any light. They say they just want to do things out the goodness of their heart. And I just love this. And can you imagine being one of the families that get that call from the store and maybe you were struggling and they tell you that, that your whole layaway is paid off and your kids get their clothes, their coats, the Christmas gifts, and you didn't have to pay for it.
Yeah.
They said people cry.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, I am impressed by the generosity, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I am also impressed by the fact that this guy has kept his anonymity for 25 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's a good quote in the story where the guy he's gotten a little cocky with his anonymity now. He says, like, trust me, even my family members, they're not going to be able to figure this out, even though there's some biographical details about him in the story.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know, man. This is the internet era. I think he's being a little fast and loose with his anonymity. I think someone's going to figure it out. I hope they don't, by the way.
Yeah.
But it is amazing that he's been able to do this for so long. No one's ever known, and he still doesn't want to be known. And I don't know if I could personally relate to that impulse, but I admire it a great deal to want to do something for someone, for lots of people, and to truly refuse credit for it.
Yeah,
it's a rare trait.
And by the way, he put this on his credit card, according to that. So he's paying for it all at once. But, you know, but he's very generous. And I appreciate people like this doing acts of kindness for no reason other than to be kind.
Yeah. And with that note, we thank our pledge supporters here at
WHR.
Just kidding. Our show today is all about President Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And the way the public views the president right now, his approval numbers have been trending down for a while. It's not like they're way below where they were in the past, but there is a little something happening, whether it's some defections within the GOP, his approval ratings on key issues like immigration and the economy that do feel a little different than the past. So we have a panel of experts, some commentators. We're going to talk about it with them and you. And we want to know, what do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval numbers? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Do us a favor and drop a comment in the chat and don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. In recent months, President Trump's approval numbers have dipped, especially on key issues like healthcare and the economy. He's at a record low when it comes to his economic policies. Just 31% of Americans approve of the job he's doing, according to a recent survey by the Associated Press.
And that's surprising because the economy used to be his top-rated issue. The White House has tried to help Trump connect with voters who are feeling the pain of inflation and the high cost of living. But just like President Biden before him, Trump seems to be missing the mark, giving himself an A++++ grade on the economy and often calling the affordability crisis a Democratic hoax.
Now, on top of that, there's infighting over the Jeffrey Epstein files, the fallout with former loyalist Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the slew of recent GOP election losses, and just last week, defiance from Indiana State Senate Republicans over a Trump-backed redistricting map. So today, are these slipping approval numbers a sign that Trump's coalition is eroding? Is his influence over the GOP waning, or is this nothing but a momentary blip?
And joining us to talk about all of this, we have Terry Tracy, a conservative journalist and CEO of Broad and Liberty. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Yes, and we also have Mustafa Rashid, a Democratic strategist and the CEO of Bellevue Strategies. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cherry. Thanks for having me on, Avi, as well.
Yes, and we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere. Our question of the day is, what do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval numbers? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comments in the chat.
So I want to start by asking each of you the same question. And it's basically this. We're talking about all these potential liabilities for the president. Which of these do you see as real red flags for him? And which of these do you think we're overhyping or ultimately will not be that problematic for him politically and the GOP in general? Terry, I'll start with you.
There's no doubt that 2026 is going to be a challenging year for Republicans in Washington. I think it would have been, regardless of this particular moment, I do think that there's an aspect of this that is just sort of the natural laws of political gravity. Yeah. In a second term, I heard you, I think Avi mentioned that at the beginning of the show, top of the show. And so I think you have to view it in that context. I also think that Trump is a victim of his own success and his own worst enemy at the same time. So I think he's been able to do some things pretty effectively in the first 11 months that have taken some of the big issues that animated his coalition in 2024 off the table.
Speaking of
securing the border being the biggest one. But I think that there are others, too, both in terms of economic policy and foreign policy. And maybe we'll have the chance to get into some of those details. But they're not insignificant. And they sort of change the agenda in a way that, you know, the Overton window moves, so to speak. But he doesn't help himself by, you know, the self-aggrandizing, you know, the A++ stuff and you know, the... You know, Peggy Noonan said over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal, Republicans have sort of called this the Trump tax, that his mouth, it gets him in trouble, but the other things outweigh, right, the more substantive aspects of the policy or the coalition, the kind of voters he's brought to the Republican Party is offset by,
right,
you know, but, you know, that may not be the case.
At some point, taxes become too onerous.
At some point, right, yes. It's true. And so I think the question is whether or not we're at a tipping point with respect to that. And time will tell. They're not reaching rock bottom, but time will tell.
Yeah. Mustafa, same question to you. We've talked about all these things, right, that could be problems for the president or could be signs of emerging problems. Is there one or two that you're like, this is a real problem for him versus something that's just going to pass, like so many things have passed in the past?
Well, Avi, I think this case, from broad to narrow, and this seems sort of esoteric and a lot of people aren't paying attention, but what happened in Indiana was a big deal. The president tried all of his tactics in Indiana. He sent the vice president. He cajoled, he pleaded, he asked. They wanted Indiana to redistrict their seats in a way that Republicans would go from possibly 9 seats to 11 or 7 to 9, something like that, sort of wiping out Democratic seats there in Indianapolis. And he tried it. When that didn't work, then he threatened. He promised primaries against him. Legislators in Indiana received threats and swatting and other things like that, and they held fast against federal overreach. And so this is the first time that I can recall that Republicans have stood up to him. I've not seen that happen before. And he's also facing, you know, something that's bedeviled almost every president, you know, since President Obama had a blip, is that the economy has so many factors that are involved in the economy that it's not just one thing that you can change. And economics will tell you that it's not one president can't change the economy. They can change how people feel about it, but they can't substantively change it. And so while he says the stock market is doing well, most Americans, to Cherry's point, feel like affordability, the cost of living, is out of reach for them. Mm-hmm. And while that's out of reach, like you're not going to be able to fix that. You're not going to be able to change that. The economy kind of does what it does just based on market conditions. And the president, by and large, does not have any control.
Real quick follow up on your first point about why you think what happened in Indiana was substantive. Yes. There were Republicans who sort of stood up, sometimes on their way out the door, to President Trump. I'm thinking of like Jeff Flake years ago. And yes. So what makes this different than that? The sort of the never Trumpers who abandoned early on. What makes this different?
In this regard, they felt that they no longer needed to tie their political future to this president. Mm-hmm. They knew he's never going to be on the ballot again, and that they needed to stand what was best for them. The politics of this is when you take a safe Democratic Republican seat and you try to expand it, you're going to add in votes that may dilute your ability to win. And so a lot of them felt their own self-preservation was at risk. They didn't want to do that. And they said things, you know, they were preserving democracy, which was sort of remarkable to have Democratic talking points. But they held firm. And as it stands now, they're not going to do it. And again, this is the first time that I can recall Republicans stood up to President Trump and said, no, they're not going to do something.
Yeah. And did you want to comment on that, Terry?
No, I mean, I think that it was a victory for conservatives, like small C conservatives, yes. folks who have been making constitutional arguments over the course of not just the Trump presidency, but the Biden and Obama presidencies as well. So it was a victory for conservative principles, constitutional principles, and Republican principles. That being said, I would dispute this idea a little bit that Republicans are not willing to stand up to the president. I think John Thune has done so on the filibuster, right? And Ted Cruz and a handful of conservatives said we're not going that path there. So, you know, I think those are the kinds of that's Trump's impulsiveness that gets him in trouble. We'll redraw the maps. We'll get rid of the filibuster, right? And he's not thinking necessarily about the long-term implications because he is so convinced that if we just enact my policies, it's all going to resolve itself. And even to the extent he's right, it doesn't matter because in democracy, process matters. And when both any party, either party, any president is able to just throw process out the window, it does significant damage to the country.
Yeah. And so thank you for that. I want to read this email from Hal, who says Trump's dipping approval rating is largely because he ran on affordability. And now he's saying that affordability is a hoax and the economy is just fine. And I want to play this clip because Trump went back to the basics. The thing that he does great is tour and bring the crowds together and talk directly to his base. And he came to Pennsylvania to launch this affordability tour. And take a listen to part of what he had to say when he was here.
But they use the word affordability, and that's their only word. They say affordability, and everyone says, oh, that must mean Trump has high prices. No, our prices are coming down tremendously.
And so, you know, this is the thing that people used to hammer Biden on when he was running for president. And then, of course, kind of stepped out of the race. But this was one of the big issues. Trump doesn't like to admit failure. Your thoughts on this, Mustafa, as he tried to he says it's a communication problem, not an actual problem. Your thoughts?
It is an actual problem. And to Terry's point earlier, the president is being his own worst enemy on this. Is he specifically said numerous times the gas prices were going to go down, the price of eggs were going to go down, the price of coffee. He specifically said on day one that certain prices were going to go down. And that's just not possible for a president to enact a policy on day one for prices to go down. And so you know, he could have couched it and had a little less hubris in the process and said, you know, we're going to work for affordability. We're going to work to have these things. But when you make a definitive statement, you say you're going to do something on day one, people have an expectation that's going to happen. And by and large, based on the economic numbers and the data now, the polls, no one feels that the price of living is any less than it was a year ago.
Yeah. And why do you think, Terry, that Trump isn't just accepting this and just saying, you know what, look, this is not something I can fix overnight. Why not just level with the American people, tell them that it takes time versus acting like it's a hoax?
No, I think that's right. You know, the president doesn't really do nuance, if you haven't noticed. But, you know, Biden's challenge was it was 4 years in and he was making this argument. You know, this guy's 11 months in and he's cleaning up a bit of a mess. And I do find the Democrats' criticism on this particular issue to be sort of amusing. It's a little bit like a chain smoker getting sick, right, and blaming the chemo for being the issue. The country has a lot of work to do in order to get out of the hole that was dug by the Biden administration economically. I think there's two things that the president should focus on that I think would pay dividends. The first would be level with the American people and say, look, my tariff policy, we're probably sacrificing roughly a point of GDP. And so what that means is there's going to be slower growth as a result of these policies. But the impact of trade balance and long-term investment in the country, like the U.S. steel Nippon deal in Pennsylvania, which is going to attract $100 billion worth of investment and create 150,000 jobs in Pennsylvania alone, those kinds of deals are going to pay dividends. So I know this is tough. I know this is painful, but I'm asking you to hang with me because these things are going to pay off in the long run.
How could he do that, given what his rhetoric has been?
Well, you're just asking how would you fix it? No, I didn't say he'd do it, but that's the reality. That is the factual reality.
I guess my point is that he is tethered to his style, maybe more than any president, although every president has a style, right? Yeah. He is so tethered to his way of presenting information. I'm going to fix it. I'm the only one that can fix it. I'll fix it right away. There's an urgency to the way he speaks. It's responsible in some ways for his rise. But then you get into this exact situation where they're trying to do a long-term play on the economy.
Right. But he is the only one that can fix it. There's not been a politician who's been this effective in getting major economic policy through. Outside of maybe the Recovery and Reinvestment Act in the Obama administration, this is the most significant play in terms of restructuring the American economy we've seen in some time. I will also say what's going on in the background, though, that nobody is talking about, or at least not talking about in the right terms, is AI is here. Mm-hmm. And that is what's creating, I think, a lot of unease amongst Americans. I mean, places like New York, and they've been expensive for a long time. Mm-hmm. This is not new. I think the trouble is, well, if things get more expensive, I'm going to be able to keep pace with it, right, ultimately. And my kids are going to be able to do better than I'm doing. And I think that there is so much unspoken unease out there around what the future of the American economy and, frankly, the world is going to look like around this now that it's here. Addressing that more proactively would pay a lot of dividends. I think politically, the problem is it would require a level of empathy that, you know, this administration, quite frankly, struggles with.
I also think, like, the obvious, I don't know, obvious, but if you look at Trump's backstory, his history, and what he said in the past, I feel like this, like, something like AI would be an issue where he would say, I want to counteract the power of the tech elites. I think this AI is bad, essentially. But he's not doing this, I think, probably because he realized he can't do it on some level. And I feel like maybe what his instincts here are at war, maybe like his political instincts are at war with reality on some level, and he can't do what he wants to do. Because I do think there's a lot of anxiety around AI. And I don't know if he feels like he has the footing to address it or what exactly. Because he hasn't been like Mr. Populist Trump when it comes to AI, best I can tell.
I think the truth of the matter, the Democrats are at a slight advantage now because they aren't in charge of any of the policies to get anything done.
Right.
So it's easy to say, that's not working. And I would say a year ago, nothing was working very well by and large then. It's just who's in charge right now. And Trump's inability to do the nuance part, to explain that part, is harming him because he doesn't have the ability to explain that there's a long tail to this, that economic policies take a while. And meanwhile, he says things that are very unhelpful, that this is a hoax, and Democrats are just saying the Republicans are in charge and things are bad. And that's a very simple, punchy statement to make. And people could relate to that because they don't feel like their lives are better or they can afford life any better than they did a year ago. And they're always going to blame the person in charge. when you're in charge of the president, the party that's in charge will always get blamed for it. They always get the credit or the blame, whether fairly or not. That's just how it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I want to remind you, our listeners, you can join the conversation. Our question of the day is, what do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval numbers? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. We have folks who are saying, Brian from Morristown says, people are finally waking up to who Trump really is. He only cares about himself, his legacy, power, and money, and he will do anything to ensure the last three. He will always deny any wrongdoing and will deny, deflect, and deceive anything portraying anything negative about him. And so I wanted to follow up a little bit with you, Mustafa, because you touched on a point about Democrats. They're sort of pointing, blaming Trump. It's a much easier job than actually coming up with real solutions and getting stuff right. But Democrats were actually winning the affordability argument, and they were doing a great job. And then they you know, from their own party, the members of their party thought that. So what should their, and then they kind of caved, you know, when it came to the shutdown.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on how they're handling this and even Trump's response, you know, to his refocus, his attempts to refocus on this particular issue.
Yeah, the congressional Democrats' focus on the shutdown was about health care, and that if they could push the Congress to a point where they could extend the expiring subsidies for people's health care insurance that's scheduled to go up in a few weeks, and they were trying to frame it around the issue. And even if you lost and you capitulated on the shutdown, you could get this vote. And so far, loosely, they've been able to get. They were promised a vote. The vote happened last week. The vote failed last week. Healthcare is the subsidies are going to expire and healthcare is going to go up. And so it plays into the discussion about affordability, because right now affordability is on the table and you're for healthcare. I mean, you're hearing people saying that their premiums are going to go up 30, 40, 50%.
So we talked about the countdown. The countdown for
coming.
That is on.
It's coming. Yeah. You know, about 24 million Americans are getting these subsidies, and the estimated about half of them will no longer be able to afford their healthcare. They just won't be able to get it anymore. So Democrats can make this argument that they put something on the table, they got the vote that they asked for, Republicans said no to it, and now your health care is going to go up, the cost of it is going to go up. So they're going to win that argument if they can clean that up as best as they can. And so when you have to pay more for your health care, then that's less money for gas, less money for food, less money for other things that are in your life, you're going to feel that pinch a little bit more.
Yeah. And Terry, do you think, I mean, this issue of affordability is getting worse when you talk about the health care? Republicans didn't bring any real solutions to the table here. Your thoughts on, you know, as those premiums start to hit people in the next few weeks, how is Trump going to address this on this affordability tour?
Those subsidies aren't the answer to the problem. Those subsidies are driving the problem, because it's more government spending in a sector that's already overregulated, in which the Affordable Care Act created more demand and there's less supply for funding it. So it's just, there is such a structural problem. The politics of this don't matter in some ways, because it's all a short-term play. Yeah. Whoever wins the next election on this issue is going to carry the football and then lose the next election because they didn't fix it. And the pendulum's just going to keep swinging. And I think that's something, if you step back and look at this in a bit of a historical context, when you had this sort of, we'll call it 20th century post-war equilibrium, where you didn't really have these major shifts, election, there's kind of a governing consensus. One house might have a narrow majority here or the other, the parties traded. But what you're seeing here is such a massive swing from one election to the next election, year after year, because neither party is really capable of putting together a governing coalition to actually pass their laws through, their ideas through a legislature, codify them, and have them take action. It's all done through executive order,
reconciliation.
Right? Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. Nothing is less. So it almost doesn't matter because the underlying issues are not being addressed and the structural problems are not being solved. So all you're doing, it's hot potato. And whoever's holding the hot potato, you lose. And then the next one comes back. And so it really speaks to a lot of dysfunction in our government that is, it's much bigger than Trump.
To Terry's point, the last, I can't recall the last bipartisan bill that wasn't done through a reconciliation process. What it basically means is that each president that started their presidency, they have this narrow window where they can get a major piece of legislation done. It's very behind the scenes. But after that, they don't get a lot of other things done. But outside of that process, I can't recall the last time something was done on that. And so it is a bit of a hot potato. You know, Democrats have it for a while and they do it. I think this is one of the cases where more than one thing can be true. that while subsidy, while extending the subsidies isn't exactly the right solution, it's the only solution that's on the table right now that's the least painful. And I don't think anyone wants to say, okay, well, that's the wrong solution, and realize they don't have the time or the ability or the political power to come up with the right solution. Yeah. So right now, we'll just keep extending.
And the question is, who are the voters going to blame?
Because they're going to blame the party in charge.
They're going to say, when they can't get health care, they're going to blame Republicans because they're holding the potato.
Correct.
And I think what we're talking around here is the idea that none of this, what's happening with Trump in his first year, is singular or specific to Trump at all. Right. It's just the pendulum swing of politics that Terry talked about, that Mustafa talked about. And, you know, for instance, in the first year of Obama's second term, his approval dropped from 53% to 43% per Gallup. Pretty similar to what Trump's going through right now. And so I think the question, if you are a GOP lawmaker now, Terry, is how do you react to that? If you come to that same analysis of, this pendulum swinging against us right now, going to be real bad in 2026, maybe even real bad in 2028. Like, what do I do? Do I stick with Trump or do I defect? We've seen some mild defections. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the most high profile, I guess you could call what happened in Indiana a type of defection. Is that the path that you think the rank and file GOP politician will pursue? Or is it mostly going to be stick with Trump because there's really not a great option out there in the wilderness?
Well, certainly the party is going through some soul searching right now. I mean, it's trying to figure out what is its identity going to be post-Trump. Obviously all of the focus is going to be the horse race around the vice president or someone going to challenge him. But that's really just reflective of the broader debate within the party around what does this thing look like when this guy is gone? And we don't know. What I would like to see, and I think Brian Fitzpatrick in Bucks County fits a good model of this, although that's not an ideological assessment, that's just in terms of it's stylistic, is members of Congress used to be more tethered to the politics of their district and their respective constituencies than the politics of their national party, right? Yep. And I think that's when you saw, to Mustafa's point, legislation used to get done. And right now we're effectively operating as like we're working like this is a parliamentary style of government under our constitutional framework, and it's broken. It's not working because everyone feels like they have to have fealty to the de facto leader of the party or the president of the United States or leader, rather than doing what they believe is in the best interest of their district and being consistent about, you know, what they're I think that there are a number of Democrats. I would say there are a number of Democrats, even in southeastern Pennsylvania, a few come to mind, that are very removed from the actual politics of their districts. But they're much more closely tethered to national Democratic progressive policies and it's true on the Republican side. And I think if you could get folks like Brian
Fitzpatrick. Will that swing back, though? Because I feel like everything gets increasingly nationalized. I don't know.
If this redistricting arms race continues to go the way that it does, it won't swing back.
Yeah, that's a huge...
It won't.
Yeah.
I mean, you'll have more safe seats. After you go through that one cycle, you'll have more safe seats and fewer people have any reason to compromise because you'll be going correct.
Yeah.
It'll be all about primaries. That's what it's
going to
be about.
Yeah, I mean, just last week, we on Broad and Liberty published two pieces. One was stop governing by executive order, everybody. Yeah. And the gerrymandering arms race has to stop.
Yeah.
Because these are the two really good examples of, as I mentioned before, in democracy process matters. And it doesn't – both parties are doing it and there are plenty of examples on both sides. But if you just allow the framework – to be disregarded in the interest of political or partisan gain at all times, all of the time, it's just it doesn't end well.
Yeah, it's breakdown of democracy. Yeah, we have a bunch of comments coming in on Facebook online. We have Judy Bennett who says, let's remember the number one reason that Trump wanted to run in 2024 to stay out of jail. Hard to hear rational talking about this felon, please. That's what Judy has to say. Look, a bear 88 says on YouTube 100% also wants to do whatever he wants with zero consequences. He stinks and people are starting to smell it. That's according to
the YouTube Look-A-Bear. Chat is happening today.
It's popping.
Keep the chats and the calls coming. 888-477-9499 studio2 at whyy.org. Much more to come after the break.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking this hour about President Trump's dipping approval ratings on key issues and about what's at the root of voter dissatisfaction. With us this hour are Mustafa Rashid, a Democratic strategist and president and CEO of Bellevue Strategies, and Terry Tracy, a conservative journalist and CEO of Broad and Liberty.
And now we're welcoming back Victor Martinez, host of Politics in Español U.S., down in Allentown. We spoke to Victor last year ahead of the presidential election about Latino voters in Pennsylvania. The Latino vote played a big part in President Trump's victory, but now there appears to be an erosion of Latino support. So, Victor, welcome back to Studio 2.
Well, thank you for having me.
And, of course, we want to remind you, our listeners, about our big question this hour. What do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval numbers? Call 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, or drop a comment in the YouTube/Facebook chat.
And so, Victor, Latino voters swung toward Trump last year, then away in 2025's off-year elections. What are you hearing in Allentown from the voters you speak with?
Well, not just in Allentown. I mean, our morning show airs in Philadelphia, the Lehigh Valley, Reading, up to Lancaster. And obviously, immigration is a big issue with the Latino community. But more interesting with the Puerto Rican community here in Pennsylvania, almost a million Puerto Ricans live in Pennsylvania. It's the way this immigration enforcement is being handled. When you talk to Latino voters who voted for Trump and wanted Trump to, like a lot of people, to deport the criminals and the rapists and the drug dealers. And now all of a sudden we see in our communities ICE agents going to church to pick up people, schools, daycare centers. We don't like that.
Yeah. I'm curious specifically because I remember you telling us about Puerto Rican voters in general, seeing immigration enforcement as something that maybe wasn't going to affect them personally, but of course they're U.S. citizens. And I'm curious, have you sensed a change in that feeling, feeling like immigration is a more personal issue to me now than perhaps I thought it was 12 months ago, or is that fairly static?
Absolutely. I mean, when we talk about an election or do it in an election, well, immigration, the border is not really something that Puerto Ricans pay more attention or a lot of attention to it because, again, we don't have those immigration problems. We are U.S. citizens. And so it's not a big topic. It's not a big issue. The economy, education, those are big topics for us Puerto Ricans, including myself. But it has now become an issue because what I said before, when you go through our social media and you see people being picked up in court while they're going to their appointments. So these are people who are trying to do the right thing, trying to go through the legal process of staying in the United States, and they're being picked up in the hallways of the courtrooms while they're going to their appointments. Then that's something that we don't like. Those are our friends. When we see our friends, our neighbors, scared to go to church or scared to drop off their kids at their school or scared to go to a daycare because what we see in social media is ICE agents, again, picking up people who are not criminal. They're just people who are here contributing to the economy and working. Then now all of a sudden Puerto Ricans care a little more than during the election cycle.
Are people expressing regret? Are they saying that, you know what, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have voted for Trump? Are you feeling people sort of going that far versus saying we didn't think Trump was going to do this?
I've seen both. I've seen people who are regretting voting for Trump. I do see some who are still on the fence and will tell me, and they call me on the radio and they say, you know what, I'm not quite there yet where I regret it, but I am not happy with what's going on.
Yeah. And so quick follow up to you. I mean, is this an opportunity for Democrats?
Absolutely. Absolutely is an opportunity for Democrats to go back to the Latino community and say, hey, listen, come back to us. Come back to give us a chance. But, you know, something that we always tell both parties, Puerto Ricans got their own issues. Mexicans got their own issues. Salvadorians, Guatemalans, just because we all speak Spanish doesn't mean that we are all the same or that we have the same backgrounds or the same problems. So we can't be painted all with one brush. They really have to pinpoint what each community, and you know what? That's why it's so difficult for both political parties to try to get this message to the community. I'll give you an example. During the election, one of the things that I criticized from the Kamala Harris campaign was they were airing a Spanish commercial in our radio station with Mexican music, mariachi, Mexican theme. Well, we are Puerto Ricans here, right? If you look at Allentown, Allentown is about 60, 70% Puerto Rican. Same thing in Reading, same thing in Philadelphia. So airing a commercial with a Mexican theme, with a Mexican mariachi, is not going to get the attention of the Puerto Ricans that vote in Pennsylvania. Same thing in Miami. You can't go to Miami where you have a big Cuban population, or New York, where you have a big Dominican population. And so that makes it difficult for both parties. I hope that they learned their lesson. But to answer your question, yes, Democrats now have an opportunity to reach back to the Latinos and say, hey, come back to us. We care about you. We will listen to you, whatever they think it's the right message to convey.
Always great insight from Victor Martinez, host of Politics in Espanol US. Thank you so much again for your time, Victor, on Studio 2.
Thank you.
I want to bring in a caller now. This is Jordan from Elkton, Maryland, on the line. Hey, Jordan, you're on Studio 2. We've been asking folks, what do you think is behind Trump's dipping approval ratings? I'm curious if you have an answer to that question.
Hi. What I think of is the how alarming it is that so many ICE raids are going on and people are basically going missing. I mean, it really reminds me of the stories I heard about the 40s in Germany where people just went missing. I think that's a really big aspect of why the approval rating, it's one thing to talk about immigration and another thing to crack down on it in such a violent, aggressive, and scary way.
Interesting comment from Jordan. Look, if there's a visual component to this first year or so of the Trump administration, yeah, it is, you know, that you see on social media that's really in your face. It's probably nothing with the economy. Yep. It is immigration enforcement, because that is something that you can see. Now, there are lots of deportations you never see. They're administrative, yeah, but there are some that you can see. And I'm curious, Mustafa, how you see that affecting Trump's popularity. Just the fact that with a camera, we can record and transmit how this particular policy is being enacted.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it, at least to most people, it feels inhumane. It feels sort of over the top, and that maybe we should have a different process in how that we do this. It's funny, to Victor's point, I do think Democrats can learn from this. Miami just elected its first Democratic mayor in 30 years, which is a big deal. I mean, and the nuances of the Latino community in Miami are very different than anywhere else. It's a lot of Cuban Americans, and they have typically voted as Republicans. And so for them to vote for a Democrat, it's there. But in cities all across the country, you are seeing ICE agents in an enforcement level that seems very aggressive. In some cases, they've taken American citizens, they've taken American veterans, they've taken people who do not have deportation orders at all, and people are being taken off the streets. And I don't think any of us thought that that's how it was supposed to go, but that is how it's happening.
Yeah. Curious for your thoughts on that, Terry, because we actually had you on the show prior talking about this issue. And, you know, in a strange way, this is a promises made, promises kept part of Trump's agenda. Like, there were signs at rallies, deportations now. Maybe people didn't envision what that looked like. Yeah. I mean, but it goes. I'm curious, like, could Trump pivot on this issue given how much he promised exactly this?
Yeah, I know that critics of Trump have used this issue to sort of chip away at the popularity of his proposals or what have you. I would say the first year, if you were to ask me what are the images of this administration, I would point much more towards the foreign policy stuff. I think the release of the hostages from Hamas was a big deal. I think meeting with President Xi, meeting with Vladimir Putin, not all necessarily slam dunk successes, but I do think the administration has had significant progress on the foreign policy front that should not be overlooked. A part of the foreign policy was to shut down the border and effectively treat it like a foreign policy challenge internally as well, and rather than a sort of police action or a domestic issue. And I think that was always going to be the million-dollar question as it related to this, right, was how is that in practice going to be received by people? Nobody likes it. Nobody likes it. And we could sit here and go case by case, oh, no, they should have done it differently, this or this was bad, or here they got a bad guy. We're talking it 50,000 feet in a way that's not particularly productive. The one response I would have to the woman who called from Elkton would be, I think it's much less comparable to 1930s German and much more comparable to the people that were disappearing from the streets of Kensington because of the fentanyl crisis. So, you know, there is a trade-off here that politically is really very challenging. Mm-hmm. But shutting down the border, getting the drugs to stop flowing from across the border, there are real policy wins in there that the Trump administration should tout. And of course, whatever they do in terms of deportations, they should do lawfully and they should do as humanely as the situation, you know, requires or warrants.
Yeah. By the way, AD on Facebook says people waking up and realizing that those who saw this coming were correct and they didn't heed the warnings. Now that they are being directly impacted, they are having voter's remorse. By the way, I want to talk a little bit about 2026 because it's days away at this point. Mm-hmm. And I know it's like and what I read, more than 50 members of the House are leaving. More than 30 of those are Republicans. And I think that number may be higher. You got multiple senators leaving. I think 7 at least. That number is creeping higher every day. I want to get your thoughts on what it says when so many lawmakers want out, and especially Republican lawmakers. Your thoughts, Mustafa?
Yeah, well, Trump was interviewed over the weekend by the Wall Street Journal, and he acknowledged that he wasn't sure if his economic policies would translate to victories next November during the midterms. That they were a little more nuanced, they were going to take a little bit longer time. And remember that only two presidents have gained seats during the midterm. That was Bill Clinton in 98 and George Bush during the Iraq War in 2002. So it's, by and large, you're going to lose seats. And so I think they're facing that. There's not an expectation that's going to happen. There are warning signs all across the country that Democrats are outperforming. And I think a lot of Republicans don't want to be a part of that. And Trump does remember in 2018 when Democrats picked up, I believe, 40 seats in his midterms. And his presidency was sort of effectively over at that point. You know, his impeachment trial started, oversight hearing started. And so I think he didn't want that to happen, which is why this redistricting arms race came about. But it looks like it's going to happen regardless of what people are trying to get done.
And I want to get your thoughts, Terry, as well. I mean, you have so many Republicans who are just saying, you know, I'm out. And I wonder if it's even fun being a lawmaker at this point, because stuff isn't getting done. If you speak out, you may get in a battle with the president. Like, just your thoughts on what it says when you have so many Republicans willing to step aside.
Yeah, and to Mustafa's point, this is not particularly unique to Trump. I think this has happened in each of the prior administrations that were two terms. This is sort of the way things go. Obviously, what happened this past November, to the extent it's a canary in the coal mine, is letting you know it's going to be a tough year for Republicans. It wasn't just that Republicans didn't win in states that tilt blue, like Virginia and New Jersey. It was sort of the nature of the losses.
Yeah, the margins.
The margins. Yeah. But, you know, I think you got to take the long view here and say, well, I mean, we are running against Democrats, and there's very little policy cohesion with respect to how they I mean, the difference between the woman who won in Miami and the gentleman who won in New York could not be more stark.
Yeah.
Right? So they're agreeing that Trump bad, and they're agreeing that it should be more affordable. Yeah. But I think, to our point, to the conversation earlier, once they get in there, what are they really going to do? And the one thing I would say, and this is probably a rabbit hole, whatever they do for the good of the country, if there's a Democratic House in January 2027, can the first thing they do not be to draw up articles of impeachment? Can we just not go down that path again?
I want to bring in real quick this comment from Charlie on Facebook. Trump could have an 80% approval, and mainstream media would use their pseudoscience to flip the numbers. This is a very typical sort of MAGA response to what's going on. It's not real. It's made up by the media. You know, Trump sort of never takes an L. He never accepts defeat. That has been such a powerful brand for him. It's really attached him to his base. But we are now in year 10, essentially, of this. Yeah. And at some point, every political act wears thin, whether it is the way Obama presented Obama's rhetoric of hope and change, that wore thin for some people. Trump's like the polar opposite. I just wonder how much longer he can go to the well of it's fake or the shock value well. Do you feel like he's starting to come up empty at all, Terry?
Well, his point about the press is real, and that's not Trump. I mean, I founded Broad and Liberty because I did not believe that conservatives generally got a fair shake in the media. And I don't think, not only is Trump not any different, he's probably been treated like the worst. And so I do think that within legacy media in particular, there needs to be more of a level playing field. People need to get all the information they need so they can make their own decisions. That is a real issue. The problem is that I think Trump, he made a post on Truth Social sometime last week calling the press seditious and libelous, sure, and something should be done about not helpful, right?
Yeah.
Not,
but my bigger question, question is beyond that as we wrap up. It's not even so much like not helpful, right, wrong, whatever. It's just that when you press something so hard to the extreme for so long, at some point people just, I think, start to roll their eyes and like, eh. Like, has he reached that point, or does that type of rhetoric still have an impact? We only have 15 seconds, but yeah.
No, I mean, any president, not only in their second term, this guy's effectively been for
exactly
10 years.
Three terms in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. People are going to start to tune
time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we didn't tune you guys out this hour. You're both wonderful. Terry Tracy, CEO of Broad Liberty. Mustafa Rashid, President and CEO of Bellevue Strategies. Appreciate both of your times today on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for everybody on the Facebook who had their hot takes.
Yes.
At Facebook and YouTube. We appreciate you and all the folks who emailed and called in. And thank you, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Adam Sanishevsky and Tina Kalakay, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.